Guttridge, and I'm delighted to welcome our international guest of honour, Michael Connolly. He doesn't need an introduction, of course. He's here to talk about his new book, The Scarecrow, in which Jack McAvoy returns. I'm sure we'll then end up talking about many of his other books and his career generally, and then you'll have a chance to ask questions of him, and then he'll be signing copies of these and other books in the signing room. Will you please formally welcome Michael Connolly?
Thank you. Thank you.
So tell us about The Scarecrow, Michael. How long ago did you decide Jack needed to come back?
It was funny. When I first wrote about him, it's going back 14 years in the book, The Poet, and I wrote that book in the first year after I had retired as a journalist and I became a full-time writer, and I felt like exercising some of my demons from the years on the police beat, and I wrote the book. And the experience was fresh in my mind, and that was 14 years ago. When I was finished that book, I thought that was pretty much it. I wouldn't really want to go back to Jack or to the world of newspaper business, and so that was it. But then in recent years, very recent years in the United States, the newspaper business has really taken a nosedive, and you know, people say it's a downward spiral. It's looking to me like it's a death spiral, and several significant newspapers have closed their doors in the last year. And watching that, also being inspired by the show The Wire, which in its last season had a, I guess what you call a B story that was about the newspaper business, all that kind of made me think, well, you know, maybe I should check in on what Jack's been doing for 14 years and construct a story that, of course, would first be a thriller, a hopeful page-turner, a mystery, all the things that I do and that we need in our books, but also have a little bit of a reflection of what's going on in this, in the industry of the newspaper business, and so that's where it came from.
And was it easy to kind of find Jack again, in, you know, inside your imagination?
It was to a degree, and I wrote a first draft very quickly. What happened when I wrote The Poet was it was the fastest book I ever wrote because there was no step back to think about what would this character who I've created, say Harry Bosch, do. I just had to write what I would do in any circumstance because Jack was very, while his history was not mine, his view of the world, his view of journalism was totally mine. So I just wrote it. There's no like looking away from the screen, so to speak. And so that was a very quick book. And so I thought, oh, this will happen again. And so I wrote the first draft of The Scarecrow without looking away from the screen. The only problem was 14 years had passed, and news gathering and the news business is quite different. The evolution has brought it into a high level of technology where, you know, back when I was a reporter, you went to a press conference, you then hurried back to the newspaper to write it up. Well, now reporters take their laptops and they go online and they're filing their story as the press conference is taking place. Newspapers Twitter, newspapers have agreements with local news, local TV channels where the reporters get on TV and they don't have to look slovenly like they did when I was there, and they have to look presentable when they talk about the stories that will be in the paper the next day. So a lot of the business had changed, and I wrote this first draft without even reflecting that. And so what happened was I gave that to some of my friends who were still in the business, and then I took a break and worked on something else. And they got back to me and said, hey, it's a good story, it's a page-turner, but you can tell you've not been in a newsroom in 14 years. So suddenly the dreaded word research came up, and I had to research what I was writing about before I went in and did my second and third drafts. And so so getting into Jack's mindset was okay, but getting into his world was not as easy as when I wrote The Poet.
Yeah. Do you want, without giving too much of the plot away, do you want to say a little bit about how the plot evolved for you?
Well, I mean, it's very short form and probably irresponsible, but there within the industry of journalism, it's very quickly to say the internet is killing the newspaper because readers are not reading the paper anymore. They're getting their news online, and advertisers are following them online, and so the newspapers are in an economic crisis. And it's really, as much as it's nostalgic and it hurts me, because I wouldn't be sitting here if I hadn't spent all those years as a newspaper. It taught me to write. It got me into the world that I write about now. So it hurts me that the newspapers are going away, it appears. But I'm not saying the internet had killed the newspapers, because the newspapers could have taken advantage of the internet, I think, at a time, and they didn't. So in many ways, it's their own fault. But with that as a background, I decided I would use the metaphor of this changing technology and the evolution that is changing our reading habits and our news reading habits, and I would carry that into the plot of the story. So I wanted to have a story where the killer, or the villain, I guess you should say, has harnessed the internet for his nefarious tastes and needs and deeds. And so that's where it started with. And just not this book, but in several books, I've been interested in the advances of technology and the sad construct that for every great invention and advance that we make, there's always going to be somebody in a dark corner figuring out, how do I turn it against them? And the villain in this book, a guy named Carver, is one of these people who turns it against people. And it was really, that was just kind of born out of the idea of following this metaphor of what technology has wrought.
Yeah. Well, you talked about research as being dread research, that dread thing research. But in fact, it seems to me that that out of your research, I'm imagining that you get actually some really great ideas, because there are some horrific things going on in this book that the internet is, or that people who misuse the internet are capable of.
Yeah, I mean, but I'm, to me, the great pleasure in my life as a writer is the actual writing, not preparing to write. And I know there are writers who spend an allotment of time researching and then they start writing, and I've never done it that way. An idea has struck me, an inspiration has hit me, and I want to get on my computer and start writing. In many ways, it used to be what they used to say about the LAPD, they shoot first and ask questions later. And often I write and I'm firing off emails to people who I know can help me, police detectives. I have a guy, he was a private detective, and he did a lot of his work as a private detective online, and then he had some health issues that forced him into an early retirement, and he's a guy I use as a researcher, and I am constantly firing off emails. Find out public schools start in L.A. this coming September. I need the date. Little things like that to big things. And he has a license to float around out there on the internet and find me weird stuff and find me scary stuff and stuff that you want to look away from. And in this book, the villain has a personal, I guess you would say, a personal sexual taste that when you read this, you'll probably think it's off the page. Well, I'll just tell you to Google it, and you'll find news groups and discussions about this. And it's something that you would think no one would ever admit that they are into this. But there's, and that kind of echoed my whole idea about what technology has wrought. Whereas 25 years ago, if you were into what this guy's into, you would hide it from everyone. You wouldn't even tell your mother. And now you can go on the internet and find acceptance. And does acceptance, finding other people who enjoy the same thing, does it lead you towards being bold and acting out and so on and so forth? And that was just an issue that an FBI agent I know, who is involved in profiling bad people, expressed to me once. And that was the seed of an idea. You know, that he said, I mean, I put these words into a character named Rachel Walling, who's an FBI agent. I put these words into her mouth, but it was this, a male agent told me, you know, the internet is a great meeting house for everything that's good and everything's bad and everything that's okay. And I don't even make any statements that the internet leads to bad people acting out. I don't even know that. I'm just saying I'm writing a story where that question is asked.
You seem to imply that the first draft, before you had to change it to bring it up to date in the newsroom, you did it pretty fast. Are you a fairly fast writer?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of like what I'm saying. I don't want to research. To me, writing's about momentum. It's getting up on the wave, like on a surfboard, and wanting to stay on there as long as possible. So if I get momentum, the last thing I want to do is stop writing and look something up. But if I have momentum, the words come quickly. The story seems to kind of crystallize. I seem to know where I'm going. I don't use an outline. I don't use anything like that. I just am heading towards a light at the end of the tunnel. I always kind of know how my stories are going to end, and I'm heading in that direction. And if you get on the wave, you do whatever you can to stay on it, and that often results in a book that comes sooner rather than later. I mean, early in my career, I would have never revealed how fast I've written some of my books because I think wrongly people will equate speed with lack of quality. And what I found is the books that have taken me the longest to write are the ones I struggled with, and that struggle comes out in the reading process, I believe. So it's the books that move quickly in the terms of the writing of them, I think, are also the books that are read quickly that people don't want to put down and want to keep turning the pages. So whether I publicly announce how fast I write a book or not, if I write a book fast, I feel real confident in it. And this was a fast book, even with the setback of realizing I was writing about journalism circa 1994 rather than 2009.
So are you ready now to publicly announce how quickly you do write certain books?
Wait, say it again?
Are you willing now to publicly announce how quickly you have
written? Well, I will take the poet, because I said that I was pretty much writing about my own view and experience and didn't have that step back of what would the character do. I wrote the poet in less than 3 months. This book took longer. It took about 6 months, but that's still pretty quick. When I write a Harry Bosch book, it usually takes about 10 or 11 months. So it was almost half the time it takes to write one of my other books. And I was also writing about an arena that was changing rapidly, the downturn of the newspaper business. I turned this book in, I believe, in something like about November 15th. And November 16th, the LA Times, Jack works for the LA Times in this book, on a November 16th, it declared bankruptcy. So it's like I had to call up and say, you know that book I turned in yesterday? Send it back. I gotta update it. And there's updates like this all through the thing. If any of you have read The Poet, you might recall 14 years ago when The Poet, Jack worked for the Rocky Mountain News. And so in this book, this is not a giveaway. It starts on the very first page, very first paragraph. Jack is laid off from his job because of the economic downturn of the newspaper business, and the book is essentially about what he does with his last 10 days on the job. He's supposed to wrap things up. Instead, he decides, I'm going to try to go out with a bang. I'm going to try to write a story they'll remember me by. And so that's what the book's about. But in the first draft, second draft, third draft, when he gets laid off, it's a small community in the newspaper business. When layoffs are announced in Los Angeles, for example, people in the business all over the country know about it. So Jack almost immediately gets an email from his old newspaper, the Rocky Mountain News, saying, hey, do you want to come back and work for us? We have a job for you. The only problem with that is on February 27th of this year, the Rocky Mountain News went out of business. And at that point, the book was locked, as they say, in publishing. And I had to plead and say, look, this is going to be extremely embarrassing for me if this book comes out in May and in it the Rocky Mountain News is offering this guy a job. That they're going to be laughing at me like someone over there just laughed. And so I was able to convince them to let me take it back and fix it. But it was a situation where I could only work on a page. I could not make a word bump over to the next page. If the last word on that page was the word and, I had to send it in with the word and. So it was kind of like a puzzle to try to fix this thing because there's two references to it. But I was able to do it and avoid embarrassment.
And now Jack's back. Is he back for good? Are we going to see more of Jack?
I don't know. I mean, I feel the same way as I did after I wrote The Poet. I feel like I've written a story that updates where Jack is at, and it updates the business of journalism. And so I feel kind of complete about that. The only issue is that a character I really love named Rachel Walling, who was in The Poet, and she's been in a few of the Harry Bosch books, plays a very significant part in this book, and I really like that character, and I know she'll be back. And so if I bring her back, is Jack coming as a package deal? I'm not really sure. Yeah. But so.
Did you always intend, when you were thinking, presumably, about writing a few books, that you would make them all part of the same world?
That I didn't have like that master scheme at the beginning. You just keep your head down and try to write one book that will get published, and that's all I was trying to do. But then when I got some, I wrote four Harry Bosch books out of the gate. Those were my first four books. And then I wrote The Poet. And then it was after that that I started thinking, like, I should find ways of bringing these all together. And the biggest way was Rachel plays a really big part, Rachel Walling, in The Poet. And then I brought her into a Harry Bosch book. And that started cinching up all the stories, it seemed to me. And then, I did a book about a guy named Terry McCaleb. And then two books later, I brought him into the Harry Bosch thing. It all kind of comes out of the Harry Bosch series and how I try to bring little connections to it. So hopefully at the end of the day, when I'm done writing, everything will be seen as part of one mosaic.
Yeah. So when The Lincoln Lawyer came along, was it the character or was it the story that came first with that?
The story and character in that one were sort of the same. I've been struck by serendipity so many times in my writing life. Things, luckiest breaks I can't believe, have happened to me. And I was at a baseball game, and I started talking to the stranger next to me. And he was a lawyer, a defense lawyer, and he started telling me about how he works out of the backseat of a Lincoln instead of having an office. And that to me is a plot and a character, you know. So I left that baseball game with an idea for a story. Now, that was a long time ago. That was 5 years before I wrote the book. But I had that in my back pocket. And over those 5 years, on occasion, whenever I could, I went to courtrooms and I did the research little by little, the dreaded research. And then eventually hit a point where I said, thought I was ready to try to write that. And so it was character and plot together. But then when I sat down to write, one of the first things you think is, well, what do I call this guy? You know, what name to use? And that's when I went back into the so-called mosaic and looked at my prior books to look for a name. And way back in 93, I wrote a book that was about had a little reference to Harry Bosch's unknown father being a defense attorney named Mickey Haller, who had kids. So they established way back then that Harry knew he had half-brothers and a half-sister because he had seen them at a funeral. And so I thought one of those little kids could grow up to be this lawyer. So that was my way of, you know, connecting it. So it's Mickey Haller Jr.
Yeah. I mean, that must have been a zinger of an idea that you were given at the game. I mean, but you waited 5 years. Were you not worried that Grisham or somebody was going to get the same idea?
I was worried a little bit, but I wasn't prepared to do it. I mean, I am plugged in with police detectives and people like that who helped me. This was a stranger, you know, that was sitting next to me and told me about his life. And I collected his card and I said, you know, someday I'm going to write about this and I'm going to call you. And I did. But I then went to people I know, a college roommate who later became a defense attorney. I contacted him and I said, can I start hanging around with you and watch how you work? And, I wasn't worried about Grisham getting the idea first. I was more worried that if I wrote a book about a lawyer, I'm going to be compared to these titans of the legal thriller. So I wanted to make sure I really had everything nailed down. So I knew it would take some research. And I also had other, you know, this thing dropped out of the blue into my lap. I was in the middle of writing a book. I knew what I was going to write next. And so I knew I would be better served to take my time with it, even if someone like Grisham or Thoreau came up with the same idea.
But kind of staying with that, but it's a slightly different angle. Were you not then worried that by now the legal genre, the legal thriller genre, got a bit stale and a bit played out? Were you confident you could do something fresh aside from that idea?
Well, that's why this thing was such a great thing to drop in my lap. I thought it was.
That was
no matter what happened in the legal thriller thing, I hadn't seen or heard anything like this, and I thought it could be, you know, a fresh angle on it. And so I had some confidence in it. And I guess, you know, maybe it's egotistical or something, but I thought since I had not done it before, I would be a fresh voice in that subgenre, if you want to call it that. Anyway,
But what about the Brass Verdict? In the Brass Verdict, he's now got an office. Does that mean there's not going to be much more of him, or are we still going to get more of...
No, I like the character of Mickey Haller in... The Brass Verdicts is a story, I think, you know, if you read The Lincoln Lawyer, you know it's heading towards the Brass Verdicts. So it was a follow-up I felt I should do. I'm just finishing a book now. It's a Harry Bosch book, but, you know, I don't, like I said, I don't outline. I just head towards the light. But all at once, I'm writing a book, and I'm writing the book, and there something happens where Harry Bosch gets in some hot water legally, and he needs to talk to a lawyer. So suddenly, he calls Mickey Haller, and so Mickey Haller's in it for one chapter. So it's again part of that mosaic, and you know, eventually, I think it will lead to a, you know, Mickey coming back on the main stage, if you will, and he'll carry another book at least.
Yeah. What about when Bosch has turned up in other people's books? How has that come about?
I don't know. I usually hear about it after it's done. So the only one I schemed on was the unnamed cameos where Robert Crace and I traded off putting each other's characters in our books 1 year. And then I've heard, you know, that Harry was consulted by in a Joe Gore's book and a few other books. It's a nice compliment.
I mean, is it a compliment or do you feel, how dare they tamper with my character?
No, because I mean, we're all writers and we know what we're going through. And the, you know, the it's usually just a name drop. It's not like they're putting words in Harry's voice where that might. I would like to be involved in that. I hopefully I'm the one who authors anything Harry Bosch says.
Yeah.
You know, and when Bob Price and I did it, we sent each other's. It was just like a little paragraph cameo, or I think it has a name. I can't remember what it is, but. We sent them back to each other for approval, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So can we talk a bit about Bosch? I mean, he's enduring very well. Is he still as fresh for you to write about as he was when you started with him?
Yeah, it is. I mean, because, I mean, it's a little bit harder to write about him because I've dug kind of deep over, I think there's been 14 books. Mm. And so that aspect becomes a little bit harder. But I guess the he's gotten some attention, especially in Los Angeles, so... I have a lot more help. I have detectives offering to, you know, take me on cases and show me things I never even saw when I was a reporter. So, the points of inspiration for Bosch stories are greater now, and that's helped me a lot. I think I've also done a few dropped a few things into the series that have changed it along the way, revitalized it, at least in my in the creative way. You know, it's for the readers to say whether it's gone stale or not. But for me, you know, when it takes 10 or 11 months to write the book, you really have to be plugged in, and it's got to be a character that's going to try to, that's going to give you that momentum I've been talking about. And Harry still does that. I think the book I'm writing now is one of those, I look at the series as, it started, I wrote a book called Lost Light. I think it was the eighth or ninth book, and something happened in Lost Light that I think revitalized it for me. And now I've come to this book I'm writing. It's called Nine Dragons, and something happens in this book that I think sets up several books to come. It's a big change. So that kept me plugged in and excited.
Oh, that's good news. I mean, might there be a prequel in there somewhere? Because there is a big backstory that you've kind of touched on but not written about.
Yeah, there will be at some point, but I made this decision early on that seemed like the right decision, and I still think it is, but I'm paying for it now, and that is that he would age in real time, and that would give me the ability to show a character evolving, and as a city is evolving, and he would be the guy telling us about this, the changes in the city as he changed. And I guess I was coming from being a journalist. I thought that would be the best way to go. And but also that was a decision made when I was an unpublished writer trying to get my first book done. And it seemed like the right thing, but I had no idea that I first started writing about Harry Bosch in 1989. I no idea I'd still be writing about him 20 years later, and so now he's aged, and hopefully the coin of the series is a sense of reality and realism, and so the reality is this year he's 58 or 59, and so I don't think I have more than 3-4 years left of him carrying a badge. It doesn't mean it's the end of the series or anything, but I love the way he deals with bureaucracy and the politics of a police department, and I'm going to lose that aspect when he's no longer, carrying a badge. And so anyway, since time is short, I'm not even thinking about going back in time. I'm thinking about I don't want a year to go by in the next four where I don't have a Harry Bosch, contemporary novel. And when I run out of time with Harry with a badge, I've set up some stuff in the book I'm writing now that will give me some things I can write about. And then also in my back pocket is the backstory. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff I could explore of Harry in Vietnam, Harry in the early 70s. I've made some references to some celebrated cases that he had little parts of as a patrol officer. And those are all seeds planted. I've planted a lot of seeds, and we'll see what happens.
Mm. As you got more and more successful, has that put added pressure on you when you're writing your books? Has it become harder to write the more books you've done, or easier?
I don't know. I mean, it's tough to write a book, but in many ways, some things are easier. No one will believe me, but I've always written for one person, me. You know, I had a teacher in college who said, "Keep your head down and write for yourself and write every day." And, you know, I'm sorry I paid all this money for a college education, but that's all I remember. but it has really served me well, and I do that. And so I write, every time I write a book that I think I would like to read, and I just think instinctively that I'm pretty much an everyman when it comes to reading. So if it's something I would like to read, there will be people out there who will like to read it. And that takes a lot of the pressure off, you know, so... You know, it doesn't matter how many books I'm selling or whatever, because I'm writing for myself. And I write at a pace that my publisher never tells me, like, I need a book, or we need a book, or when can we have a book. I pretty much work autonomously, and I tell them when I'm going to have a book, and I write at a pace that suits me. And, you know, sometimes it's two books a year, sometimes it's one, but it seems like it's always been at least one book a year. Yeah. And I don't feel, you know, pressure to do that.
Good. When you were growing up, did you want to be a novelist or a journalist or neither of those things?
When I was in college, that's when I got the light went off over my head, and I decided I wanted to be a writer of crime novels, and that's why I went into journalism to get close to the world I wanted to write about, also to learn the craft of writing. So I went into journalism with this ulterior motive and the secret in my back pocket that this was going to be like research to the point where I felt I was ready to write crime fiction. And so that worked out. So it wasn't like I want to be a journalist and then later I thought, well, maybe I should write books. It was the other way around.
And what drew you to crime novels? Had you been a reader of crime novels when you were a kid?
I wasn't. My mother was a great reader of crime novels and passed a lot of them on to me. I was just a good reader when I was a kid. But it wasn't like a passion. And then when I was 16, I witnessed a crime. And I spent a night in a police station being interviewed and looking at lineups of the bad guys and stuff like that. And just watching how the detectives were and how they dealt with guys who they thought were criminals and so forth really fascinated me. So from that night on, I became a religious reader of the crime news in the newspaper, and then I was reading true crime books, and then I came back full circle to crime novels, back to what my mother loved, and that's where it began. And then when I was, it was like 5 years or 4 years later, and I was in college and I read the Raymond Chandler books, that's when the light went off.
Mm. And then, but because you're interested in true crime, has it always been important to you that your novels reflect real life in some way?
Yeah, I mean, that came out of, I had this idea that so many people are trying to write books and so many people are trying to get published. You know, why should I get published? What do I have to say? And, I'd spent a number of years on the police beat in South Florida, which was a high crime area, and then Los Angeles, which is another high crime area. And I thought, I got to harness this. I got to somehow use this in the crime fiction. And so I said, from the start, I would try to be as accurate as possible about everything, about police procedure, about politics, about the city, all that stuff. And I wanted to really bring a reporter's skill to writing the crime fiction. And, so that's where that came from.
And do you feel strongly that your journalism actually did help you as a writer of fiction?
It didn't. Oh yeah, absolutely.
It's not just a different way of writing that
Well, I mean, it's helped me in so many ways. I mean, like we were just talking about, if there's any kind of accuracy in my books, especially those early books, it came from being on the police beat. I knew how they did things. I worked for some big papers that were what they call I can't remember now, but they had the editions come out all day long, and you had to, especially, and crime was always, you know, a big thing, you know, this, the phrase, if it bleeds, it leads. They were always putting crime stories on the front page, and different editions, all day newspapers, that's what they call them. Different editions would come out like every couple hours, and you had to update the story, and sometimes there was no new news, and you had to just rewrite them to make it sound like, or make it read like there was something new here. And all that was fantastic training for what I was hoping to do and write crime novels.
I was thinking in terms of writing style.
When you write, as you know, when you're writing for a paper, you never have enough room. You know, they'll assign a certain length, 12 inches, and then they'll tell you, oh, we've lost that. You've got to get it down to 8. Yeah. So you learn through the repetition of working in a newspaper to make everything count. First of all, you write short sentences that every sentence has information. Everything advances the story. You don't use dialogue that doesn't include new information. And that's a way of making a short story have a lot of impact. And even though I now write books where there's no limit on what, you know, I can write a 600-page book if I wanted to, and I can be, you know, flowery and all that kind of stuff, I don't do it. I just write like a journalist. I write succinct, to-the-point sentences and paragraphs. I try to have dialogue that carries, that includes something new. It doesn't happen all the time in a novel because you also want to be realistic about conversation. And so I credit that completely to being a newspaper reporter.
Yeah, you talked about Chandler inspiring you, but are there writers who've influenced you, or have you come to your writing kind of fully formed from what you're saying, really?
No, I you know, you can't be a writer without being a reader. You know, from the point that the light went off and I said, hey, I'm going to be a crime novelist, to the point I actually had a finished book in my hand was probably 15 years. And on that time, all that time, I wasn't just thinking about doing it. I was preparing to do it. So I was reading as much as possible. And, you know, the early big three influences for me were Chandler, Ross McDonald, and Joseph Wambau. And I think the Harry Bosch series is a distillation of what's good in, hopefully, all three of those writers' work. But, you know, you read everything. You hear about something good, you read it. I can still remember, I don't do this anymore, but I actually bought a book based on, I thought the cover looked really good. And I knew nothing about the writer. And the book was Neon Rain by James Lee Burke. And just discovering him just through liking his cover and not hearing, I wasn't plugged in. It's not like now with internet and all that stuff where you can hear about a great writer or a good story or whatever. And I lived in an area that didn't have a crime specialty store, and I was kind of like on my own when I was looking for stuff. And that was like that was serendipity again, because reading him was an immense inspiration. A couple books later, he dedicated a book to his agent. And so when I finally had a book I thought should be published or was worthy of being published, I sent to that agent because I saw it in James Lee Burke's book. And he was a great writer, or is a great writer. And if he trusts his agent enough to dedicate a book to him, that must be a pretty good agent. And I ended up with that agent. So it was, you know, sometimes I scratch my head and think, what if they had put a bad cover on Neon Rain? Maybe I maybe never would have read him, or I kind of would have come to him too late.
Yeah. Could you see yourself writing Bosch in another city, or is L.A. absolutely crucial to Bosch?
I think he's constructed to be of the city, and so I can't see him moving. I obviously can do the trips out of the city, as I've done. I've taken him to Mexico, Las Vegas. This book I'm writing now, a third of it's set in Hong Kong, and you can do that sparingly, but I think it would kill the series if he left L.A. And it doesn't really even enter my mind, because from the very beginning I thought, I approached this as a reporter, that there's a a chance to use this guy as a vehicle to talk about L.A., to show the changes of L.A. I was having a drink earlier of someone who said that, you know, every crime novel is a social document. Somehow I knew that, even though I had never read one, and I wasn't involved in the critical community who views these as such. But I knew there was an opportunity, maybe because I was a journalist, there was an opportunity to use the crime novel to say something about this very fascinating and damaged city of Los Angeles, and this would be the guy to do it, because I hopefully was going to make him fascinating and damaged, and so they could be one. Mm.
Do you miss journalism?
I don't, because there's journalism in my books. You know, I think I'm trying to accurately, and I think I have to a great degree, accurately portrayed the work, the difficulty of the work, the politics of the work, the bureaucracy, and the city. And you can't just sit in your room and come up with that. You got to go out and be a reporter to a great degree. And so I don't miss that aspect. It was a huge culture shock to go from a newsroom where, you know, it's about four times as big as this room. It's desk after desk after desk, and all these reporters, and some like each other and some hate each other, and there's cliques, and there's gossip, and there's all kinds of pranks and fun stuff. And you go from that, and you're sitting in a room by yourself. that was a very difficult time for me the first couple of years that I was a full-time writer.
Yeah, yeah. Is it true that you can't envisage, or you don't have a picture of which actor you'd like to play Bosch in films or TV, or are you just not saying?
No, okay, I'll admit Keanu Reeves. No, just
write that down.
No, your writing comes out of your reading tastes, and I have never been someone who reads a book and gets the description and attributes it to a movie star or a parent or an uncle. There's two ways of reading, and there's nothing wrong with either way, but some people will immediately build a character in their head, and some people will take what's written there and attribute it to some a visual image that they're very familiar with, you know, Clint Eastwood or whatever. I've always grown up reading and building the characters in my head. So I built Harry Bosch. You know, I overwrote my first book. I wrote it over and over again because I didn't know anything about publishing, and I didn't know, you know, it was my first book. So I didn't know what I was doing to some degree. And so I lived with it for a long time. And so long before it was even published, I had a very solid portrait in my head of who he's like. And then I got it published, and then, oh, my God, they wanted another one, and then they wanted another one. And so I've just cemented that idea of image of Harry Bosch over and over again. So there's no way I can, after all these books, jump on the Russell Crowe bandwagon or the whatever, you know. And anyway, it's also kind of a waste of time exercise, because what does it mean anyway? You know, these. I don't think Harry Bosch is ever going to be made into a movie, and so it doesn't really serve me well to think about who could be Harry Bosch.
I've read things you said that you don't seem too surprised that it's not going to be a movie if it isn't going to be a movie. Why is that? I would have thought it would be very filmable.
Well, I think there's something deceptive about the series in that Los Angeles is an image-rich place. I take this, and I like to make use of it. And so I take the Harry Bosch stories through some interesting places, and I hopefully describe them well. And that gives the idea that this would be a good movie. But when you really look closely, Harry Bosch is a very internal character. He's a grinder. He's always grinding things down. He sits on his back porch and thinks about things. And I think people who like the series like it because of how he thinks and how he looks at the world. And these are things that either cannot be transferred into a film or are very hard to transfer into a film. You know, in a screenplay, you can never say what anyone's thinking. And what I think endears Harry Bosch to people, to readers, is what he's thinking. So that makes the jump to screenplay very difficult. And there's been many efforts. I love movies, so it wasn't like I was like saying, no, you can't have Harry Bosch. I sold them all over the place. And there was, you know, there's been six screenplays written on four of the books. and they just don't capture the character. And they hired me a couple times to rewrite some big-time screenwriters, thinking, well, you know, you came up with this guy in the first place. Maybe you can salvage this. And I couldn't do it either because I'm too used to working inside Harry's head. To write like a story like Trunk Music was one of the ones I worked on. Without talking about what he's thinking about, it was brutal. It was torturous. And I turned in something that was as equally bad as the other scripts.
So what do you think of the film that was made of one of your books?
It was a fun exercise. It was very interesting. It wasn't a great adaptation of the book. They changed it pretty dramatically. But when it's all said and done, if I could go back and change and not take the deal, I wouldn't do it. I'd do it all over again because, you know, to me the book is sacred. The book's untouched. And I happen to know that movie got me a lot of new readers, even though it wasn't a great movie. It wasn't a very successful movie. The movie came out 6 years after the book, and the paperback with Clint Eastwood's steely stare on the cover was the bestseller on the New York Times for 5 weeks. And those were all new readers. And countless times I've done book signings where people come up and say, you know, I discovered you after seeing Bloodwork, the movie. So I wouldn't trade anything about it, you know. I wish they had not changed the bad guy. I wish they hadn't changed the ending. But, you know, there's also James Lee Burke told me that it was like, because we had the same agent, you know. He one time told me it's like a car. If you sell your car, it's their turn to drive it. They might crash it into a wall, but it's not your car anymore. And so that's the way, it was good advice. That's the way I looked at it. It was their turn to tell the story, and they thought they should tell it this way, and they did, and I don't agree with it, but it was their turn.
Okay, that's great. Thank you for your patience with me. Let's get some questions from the audience. You got a question? Stick your hand in the air.
I just want to make an observation. I've read every one of your books, and I just imagine Harry Bosch. And he walked up on the stage this afternoon. You're
me?
Harry
Bosch.
Michael Connelly is Harry Bosch.
Wow. Take that, Keanu Reeves.
I mean, you said about Jack McFaul having your kind of attitudes and things, but I mean, how much of you is in Bosch? Are you going to admit? Thank you. Are you going to admit how much of Bosch is from you?
It depends on what book you read, because I had it in my head that when I was writing the first book, that I had no idea how long it would take. I had no idea whether it would ever be published, whether anyone other than me and my mom would read it. And so I wanted to make the process interesting and fun, you know, in case nothing ever came of it. And I, at that time, I thought what would be interesting is to write about somebody completely different from me. So when I, and every choice I had to make with him, I took the opposite tact from me. I came from a big family. I made him an orphan. I'd been married a long time. I made him unable to sustain any kind of romantic relationship. I work well with others. I was in a newsroom. I worked on different investigative teams, writing teams, all that. Harry doesn't play well with others. So just to make it interesting, I chose opposite of me. And that's how it started out. So those early books, I would say I have zero in common other than we're both left-handed. And but then, as I said, I've had some great fortune in that publishers wanted to keep publishing Harry Bosch books. So I kept writing them, and it's very hard to keep that distance over time. And so I started sharing stuff with him. I gave him a daughter who's the same age as my daughter. So, his daughter says stuff to him that my daughter has said to me. I think we share the same view, the hopeful yet cynical view of Los Angeles, and that carries further. Like, how you look at your city is a lot of the way you look at the world. And so, yeah, we have a lot in common now. And but in many ways, he does things he's the man I would hope to be in some circumstances. You know, his stalwart belief in fairness and that everybody counts or nobody counts, his dislike and unacceptance of bureaucracy, or these are things I think in my secret mind. But would I do the things he does? You know, would he? Where he kind of distributes comeuppance to people who are in his way. I'm not like that. know.
Okay. Are there bits of him, are there bits of his character that you feel a bit stuck with, that you wish you hadn't given him, or aspects of his life that you kind of feel lumbered with?
Not too much, not really. I mean, I think he's, you know, to this day, 20 years later, I think he's really interesting to me. And that to me is pretty marvelous, that 20 years with this character, and I still want to write about him. I hope I get another 20 years in. I look at little regrets, like I said, I overwrote my first book. I kept it too long. And so I look at it, especially now since I'm pushed up against this wall of when Harry's going to be too old to carry a badge, I look back and say, I wish that had been published in 91 instead of 92, because I could have gotten another Bosch book in there. That's a big regret. And then I mentioned earlier where when I was writing The Lincoln Lawyer, I went back to that second book to get the name of Harry's dad. Mm. That was covered in 3 pages. I already used up that story in just 3 pages where... if I knew there, I mean, this is my second book, so I did not know this future awaited Harry and me.
Yeah, yeah.
But that could have been a whole book. Sure. And so that's another thing I regret.
Yeah, okay. David, the other question.
Yeah, and what is your current writing routine?
My routine is, it depends on where I am in the book, but generally I'm a morning person. I like to get up around 4 and write till 12. That would, to me, is a good day. But you reach this point where... with momentum, you know, I keep talking about momentum, you reach this point of what I call critical mass, where the story is just coming all together, crashing together, and I just want to write all day. I mean, I have responsibilities to family and so forth, but there, towards the end of a book, I'll reach a point where, you know, I'm waking up earlier, I don't set an alarm, I just wake up. Sometimes I'm getting up as early as 2, and I'm just writing as much as possible, because it's going so well, and you don't, when things are going well, don't mess with it.
What's a good word day, then?
I don't really... I have this thing where I like to move the story a step forward. You know I have time. Like I said, I write on my own schedule. I'm always in touch with my publishers, and I'll tell them if the book's not going to be ready for October or whatever. So I'm not really too concerned with page counts or word counts. But I do... I really need to move the story forward a day. Every day, it has to move forward a step. And what is a step? It can be anything. It can be a whole chapter. It can be a conversation. It can be Harry Bosch, suddenly everything comes together for Harry Bosch. He suddenly realizes something. A step just makes you invigorated as a writer. It makes you feel good. And I just got to have that every day. And sometimes I get many steps in a day, but the minimum is 1 step a day. And... you know, and I know that if I accomplish that, I'll have a book in about 10 months.
There's someone, yeah. You.
You mentioned that you planted seeds that you look forward to using. Have you given any thought to planting an iconoclastic protege of Harry's to some extent, and then carrying forward through that character?
Yeah, I mean, I actually have, it's funny you should say that, I've had his partners change a little bit over time. And then I had a book a couple years ago called The Overlook, where I gave him a brand new young partner. And he was in 2 books. And in Brass Verdict, I don't know if you follow this, he was never even named. He was in a few scenes. And what that was happening was I didn't like him anymore. And so, I mean, he wouldn't be a guy who could carry on. You know, in a way, I'm not looking for a replacement for Harry Bosch, because I want to be writing about him until the day I die or the day I stop writing. But I need other significant characters, interesting characters. And I realize this guy's not going to cut it. And so the book I'm writing now involves that. Like, you know, my dissatisfaction with his partner is now Harry's dissatisfied with him. And that's like a B or C track in the story, and it's setting up bringing in the next tryout, sort of, in my next book.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
Can I just ask, what was the crime you witnessed at 16 that kicked off your initial interest, and have you ever used that in any of your books?
I wrote I think John Harvey's here. I wrote a short story for John Harvey that was a fictional account of it. That's the only time I ever used it. But it was what they would call now now I can't remember what the word is, carjacking. But in the 70s, they didn't have the phrase carjacking, but it was this guy had attempted to rob a small market. It had gone crazy or gone awry. He ran out, and there's a guy sitting in the car, and he opened the door and tried to pull the guy out so he could steal his car, and he ended up shooting the guy in the head. Now, I didn't see this. This happened like 3 blocks from my location. And I'm 16 years old. I work as a dishwasher at a resort on the beach in South Florida, and it's like 2 in the morning, and I'm sitting in a red light. I smell terrible because I've been washing dishes for 8 hours. I just want to get home and take a shower. And the intersection's deserted. I'm sitting in a red light, and I'm looking like this. Are there any cops around here? Because I'm going to run this red light so I can get home. And when I look over, I see this guy running, and he's fully clothed. It's 2 in the morning. Why would some? He's not jogging. And there's something weird about him. So I watch him, and I see him. He runs by a hedge, and he sticks something into the hedge. He just shoves a package into the hedge and keeps running. So when the light does change, I turn around, and I follow this guy a little bit from back because I know something weird's going on. And I see him go into this biker bar, motorcycle bar. So then I turn around, go back to the hedge, and I pull the package out, and it's a shirt wrapped around a gun. And just about that time, there's blue lights flashing, and police are descending on the thing, and I'm sitting there holding a gun. So, you know, so I quickly throw it back into the hedge. And then I, again, this is way before cell phones and Twitter and thing, I go to a payphone. I call and wake up my dad and tell him what I saw. And he said, well, flag down the cops and show them. So anyway, I did that. And then I said the guy went into this biker bar. Now, the guy who was running had long hair and a beard. So they go in. They go into the biker bar, and the next thing I know, it's like 20 guys with long hair and a beard, all like being marched out.
This explains why you were there all month.
Right. Yeah. So I had to keep looking at all these things. And what was interesting about it in later years is that they didn't have the guy. He must have gone out the back door or something. But the police thought I was too afraid to identify the bad guy. And so most of that night was them berating me and saying, come on, kid, it's time to step up. Be a man. And which guy is it? And I'm saying, you don't have the guy. And they're saying, yes, we do. Which guy is it? And it was a back and forth like that. And the cops trying to talk tough to me and all this stuff. Finally, you know, my father was out in the waiting room, you know, for hours, and he started making a scene saying, let my son go. And so I ended up leaving. They thought I was this little cowardly little kid who wouldn't step up and point the finger, and they never made a case because I never heard from them again. You know, I never testified. I never was asked to do another lineup or anything, and they never, as I assume, never caught the guy. And then I read in the paper about the crime, and at the time the guy who had been shot in the head still was alive, and I don't know whether he survived or what. It just kind of dissipated after that. But what was weird was the detective who was assigned to me and was being so tough of me, about 8 years later I came back to that police department as a police reporter, and I was now covering them for the newspaper. And at one point I sat down with him. I said, you don't even remember me, but I went over this thing. And he goes, yeah, we had him. You just wouldn't pick him out, would you? I was never able to win that guy over. So in a way, maybe all these detective books are my way of trying to win that guy over.
Absolutely, absolutely. Another question. The doors are locked. You can't leave. You know. Yeah, there.
Scarecrow's a very high-tech novel, and your website's very high-tech. I've got an email from your mailing list that you've got a lot of extra material online.
You know, it's the age of websites, and they're a valuable tool to promote your books and yourself, and the person who runs my website, who happens to be my sister, is very creative and is always trying to connect the book with the website and the community of people who like to read my work. Because there's a techno side to the Scarecrow, if you read this book, as you go through, there's a total of 12 websites that are part of the investigation. I had them come up with websites. And so I bought them all so I could control them. And so if you you're reading this book and you click on a website, you'll find some extra stuff. You know, it's not the greatest stuff, but it's all new stuff, added stuff that might help you with the reading of the book. Some of it, you know, like, for example, one of them connects to all the covers that were considered for the Scarecrow and then rejected before we settled on this one, and the one in the United States is a different cover as well. So it's all that kind of extra stuff. Another thing we did, which is, I think, a bit unique, is I mentioned Rachel Walling and how much I like that character. She doesn't come into this book to about page 140, which is a regret I have, but I could not figure out a way of getting her into the story earlier. So I then figured out, then I decided after the book was done and everything, well, what was she doing for those 140 pages? At one point in this book, about page 140, Jack McAvoy calls her and says, I need help. So she enters the story. So what was she doing before she got that call? And so I wrote a story. It was first going to be a short story that we would put out on the website, but I've done that before. In past books, I've had extras, like short stories. So my sister, bless her heart, had the idea, well, why don't you make a movie out of that instead of a short story, because you haven't done that yet. So I turned the short story into a screenplay, gave it to a filmmaker I know in L.A., and he shot it, and it's in three parts that are being parceled out once a week on the website. There's one up already, and then there'll be next Tuesday and then the Tuesday after. And it's about a 25-minute film about Rachel Walling on an FBI case. The FBI case is self-contained. It has nothing to do with Scarecrow, although it goes back and forth across. If you read the book and see this little film, I think there'll be a couple aha moments. But there's no spoilers or anything like that, and it ends with Rachel getting the phone call, and it's Jack saying, I need your help. And everything before that phone call has nothing to do with the Scarecrow. The one caution, because I've sat up here and pontificated about how I like to create in my head my characters, is don't look at this thing if you're going to be put off by a visual image of Rachel. Because she's been in four or five books, and I know anecdotally from my traveling around that people really like this character, and if you don't want to see someone portraying her, then don't look at this thing. Every other character is not involved in the Scarecrow. There's no other crossover characters. But anyway, that's just my little flag wave there to be cautious.
So Connolly on film finally, and that's where we've got to end, sadly. I'm not sure it's a good place to end, but it's the place we do have to end at. Michael is going to be signing copies of his books down the corridor. Thank you all for coming and being so attentive. Just like Michael Connolly.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.